No doubt about that. Then she clicked her car phone on and took the photograph back, dialed DMV in Atlanta and called in the number from the front of Stoller's truck, waited a long moment, tapping her index finger on the steering wheel. I heard the crackle of the response in the earpiece. Then she clicked the phone off and turned to me.
"The truck is registered to Kleiner Industries," she said, "and the registered address is Zacharias Perez, Attorneys at Law, Jacksonville, Florida."
I nodded. She nodded back. Sherman Stoller's buddies. The ones who had got him out of Jacksonville Central in 55 minutes flat 2 years ago.
"Okay," she said. "Put it all together. Hubble, Stoller, Joe's investigation. They're printing counterfeit money down in Kleiner's warehouse, right?"
I shook my head. "Wrong," I said. "There's no printing going on inside the States. It all happens abroad. Molly Beth Gordon told me that, and she ought to know what she's talking about. She said Joe had made it impossible. And whatever Stoller was doing, Judy said he stopped doing it a year ago. And Finley said Joe only started this whole thing a year ago, around the same time Hubble fired Stoller." Roscoe nodded, shrugged.
"We need Molly's help," she said. "We need a copy of Joe's file."
"Or Picard's help," I said. "We might find Joe's hotel room and get hold of the original. It's a race to see who's going to call us first, Molly or Picard." Roscoe clicked off the dome light, started the car for the ride back to the airport hotel. I just sprawled out beside her, yawning. I could sense she was getting uptight. She had run out of things to do, run out of distractions. Now she had to face the quiet, vulnerable hours of the night. The first night after last night. The prospect was making her agitated.
"You got that gun, Reacher?"
she asked. I squirmed around in the seat to face her. "It's in the trunk," I said. "In that box. You put it in there, remember?"
"Bring it inside, okay?" she said. "Makes me feel better."
I grinned sleepily in the dark, yawned.
"Makes me feel better, too," I said. "It's a hell of a gun."
Then we lapsed back into silence. Roscoe found the hotel lot. We got out of the car and stood stretching in the dark. I opened the trunk, lifted the box out and slammed the lid, went in through our lobby and up in the elevator. In the room we just crashed out, Roscoe laid her shiny .38 on the carpet on her side of the bed. I reloaded my giant .44 and laid it on my side, cocked and locked. We wedged a chair under the door handle. Roscoe felt safer that way. I woke early and lay in bed, thinking about Joe. Wednesday morning. He had been dead 5 days. Roscoe was already up. She was standing in the middle of the floor, stretching. Some kind of a yoga thing. She had taken a shower, and she was only half-dressed. She had no trousers on, just a shirt. She had her back to me. As she stretched, the shirt was riding way up. Suddenly, I wasn't thinking about Joe anymore. "Roscoe," I said.
"What?"
she said. "You've got the most wonderful ass on the planet," I said. She giggled. I jumped on her. Couldn't help it. Couldn't do anything else. She drove me crazy. It was the giggle that did it to me. It made me crazy. I hauled her back into the big hotel bed. The building could have fallen down and we wouldn't have noticed it. We finished in an exhausted tangle. Lay there for a while. Then Roscoe got up again and showered for the second time that morning. Got dressed again. Trousers and everything. Grinned at me as if to say she was sparing me from any further temptation.
"So, did you mean it?"
she said. "Mean what?" I said, with a smile.
"You know what?"
she smiled back.
when you told me I had a cute ass.
I didn't say you had a cute ass, I said. I've seen plenty of cute asses. I said yours was the most wonderful ass on the whole damn planet.
But did you mean it?
She said. You bet I meant it, I said. Don't underestimate the attraction of your ass, Roscoe, whatever you do. I called room service for breakfast, removed the chair from under the door handle, ready for the little cart, pulled the heavy drapes. It was a glorious morning, a bright blue sky, no clouds at all, brilliant fall sunshine. The room was flooded with light. We cracked the window and let in the air and the smells and the sounds of the day. The view was spectacular, right over the airport and to the city beyond. The cars in the lots caught the sun and looked like jewels on beige velvet. The planes clawed their way into the air and wheeled slowly away like fat, important birds. The buildings downtown grew tall and straight in the sun. A glorious morning. But it was the sixth straight morning my brother wasn't alive to see. Roscoe used the phone to call Finlay down in Margrave. She told him about the photograph of Hubble and Stoller standing in the sun on the warehouse forecourt. Then she gave him our room number and told him to call us if Molly got back to us from Washington, or if Picard got back to us with information from the car rental people about the burned Pontiac. I figured we should stay in Atlanta in case Picard beat Molly and we got a hotel trace on Joe. Chances were he stayed in the city, maybe near the airport. No point in us driving all the way back down to Margrave and then having to drive all the way back up to Atlanta again. So we waited. I fiddled with the radio built into the nightstand thing. Came up with a station playing something halfway decent. Sounded like they were playing through an early Canned Heat album. Bouncy and sunny, and just right for a bright, empty morning. Breakfast came and we ate it. The whole bit. Pancakes, syrup, bacon, lots of coffee in a thick china jug. Afterward, I lay back on the bed. Pretty soon started feeling restless. Started feeling like it had been a mistake to wait around. It felt like we weren't doing anything. I could see Roscoe was feeling the same way. She propped the photograph of Hubble and Stoller and the yellow van on the nightstand and glared at it. I glared at the telephone. It wasn't ringing. We wandered around the room, waiting. Then I stooped to pick up the Desert Eagle off the floor by the bed, hefted it in my hand. Traced the engraved name on the grip with my finger, looked across at Roscoe. I was curious about the guy who had bought that massive automatic. "What was Gray like?" I asked.
"Gray?" she said. "He was so thorough. You want to get Joe's files? You should see Gray's paperwork. There are 25 years of his files in the station house. All meticulous, all comprehensive. Gray was a good detective."
"Why did he hang himself?" I asked her.
"I don't know," she said. "I never understood it."
"Was he depressed?" I said.
"Not really," she said. "I mean, he was always sort of depressed. The goobrious, you know, a very doer sort of guy. And bored. He was a good detective, and he was wasted in Margrave. But no worse in February than any other time. It was a total surprise to me. I was very upset."
"Were you close?" I asked her. She shrugged.
"Yes, we were," she said. "In a way, we were pretty close. He was a doer guy, you know. Not really that close to anybody. Never married, always lived alone, no relatives. He was a teetotaler, so he would never come out for a beer or anything. He was quiet, messy, a little overweight, no hair and a big straggly beard, a very self-contained, comfortable type of a guy. A loner, really. But he was as close to me as he was ever going to get to anybody. We liked each other, in a quiet sort of a way.
And he never said anything, I asked her. Just hanged himself one day.
That's how it was, she said. A total shock. I'll never understand it.
Why did you have his gun in your desk? I said.
He asked if he could keep it in there, she said. He had no space in his own desk. He generated a lot of paperwork. He just asked if I could keep a box for him with the gun hidden in it. It was his private weapon. He said he couldn't get it approved by the department because the caliber was too big. He made it feel like some kind of a big secret.
I put the dead man's secret gun down on the carpet again, and the silence was shattered by the phone ringing. I sprinted for the nightstand and answered it, heard Finley's voice. I gripped the phone and held my breath.
Reacher? Finley said. Picard got what we need. He traced the car.
I breathed out and nodded to Roscoe.
Great, Finley, I said. So, what's the story?
Go to his office, he said. He'll give you the spread, face to face. I didn't want too much conversation on the phones down here. I closed my eyes for a second and felt a surge of energy.
Thanks, Finley, I said.
Speak to you later.
Okay, he said. Take care, right?
Then he hung up and left me sitting there holding the phone, smiling.
I thought he'd never call, Roscoe laughed. But I guess 18 hours isn't too bad, even for the Bureau, right?
The Atlanta FBI was housed in a new federal building downtown. Roscoe parked at the curb outside. The Bureau reception called upstairs and told us Special Agent Picard would come right down to meet with us. We waited for him in the lobby. It was a big hall with a brave stab at decoration, but it still had the glum atmosphere government buildings have. Picard came out of an elevator within 3 minutes. He loped over. He seemed to fill the whole hall. He nodded to me and took Roscoe's hand.
Heard a lot about you from Finley, he said to her.
His bear's voice rumbled. Roscoe nodded and smiled.
The car Finley found, he said. Rental Pontiac. Booked out to Joe Reacher, Atlanta Airport, Thursday night at 8.
Great, Picard, I said. Any guess about where he was holed up?
Better than a guess, my friend, Picard said. They had the exact location. It was a pre-booked car. They delivered it right to his hotel.
He mentioned a place a mile the other way from the hotel we were using.
Thanks, Picard, I said. I owe you.
No problem, my friend, he said. You take care now, okay?
He loped off back to the elevator, and we raced back south to the airport. Roscoe swung onto the perimeter road and accelerated into the flow. Across the divider, a black pickup flashed by. Brand new. I spun around and caught a glimpse of it disappearing behind a raft of trucks. Black. Brand new. Probably nothing. They sell more pickups down here than anything else. Roscoe pulled her badge at the desk where Picard said Joe had checked in on Thursday. The clerk did some keyboard work and told us he had been in 621, 6th floor, far end of the corridor. She said a manager would meet us up there. So we went up in the elevator and walked the length of a dark corridor, stood waiting outside the door to Joe's room. The manager came by more or less straight away and opened the room up with his pass key. We stepped in. The room was empty. It had been cleaned and tidied. It looked like it was ready for new occupants.
What about his stuff? I said. Where is it all?
We cleared it out Saturday, the manager said. The guy was booked in Thursday night, supposed to vacate by 11 Friday morning. What we do is we give them an extra day, then if they don't show, we clear them out, down to housekeeping.
So his stuff is in a closet somewhere? I asked.
Downstairs, the manager said. You should see the stuff we got down there. People leave things all the time.
So can we go take a look? I said.
Basement, he said. Use the stairs from the lobby. You'll find it.
The manager strolled off. Roscoe and I walked the length of the corridor again and rode back down in the elevator. We found the service staircase and went down to the basement. Housekeeping was a giant hall, stacked with linens and towels. There were hampers and baskets full of soap and those free sachets you find in the showers. Maids were pulling in and out with the trolleys they use for servicing the rooms. There was a glassed-in office cubicle in the near corner with a woman at a small desk. We walked over and rapped on the glass. She looked up. Roscoe held out her badge.
Help you?
The woman said.
Room 621, Roscoe said. You cleared out some belongings Saturday morning. You got them down here?
I was holding my breath again.
621,
the woman said.
He came by for them already. They're gone.
I breathed out. We were too late. I went numb with disappointment. Who came by? I asked. When?
The guest, the woman said. This morning, maybe 9:30.
Who was he? I asked her. She pulled a small book off a shelf and thumbed it open, licked a stubby finger and pointed to a line.
Joe Reacher, she said. He signed the book and took the stuff.
She reversed the book and slid it toward us. There was a scrawled signature on the line. What did this Reacher guy look like? I asked her. She shrugged.
Foreign, she said. Some kind of a Latino, maybe from Cuba. Little dark guy, slender, nice smile. Very polite sort of a guy, as I recall.
You got a list of the stuff? I said. She slid the stubby finger further along the line. There was a small column filled with tight handwriting. It listed a garment bag, 8 articles of clothing, a toilet bag, 4 shoes. The last item listed was 1 briefcase. We just walked away from her and found the stairs back to the lobby, walked out into the morning sun. It didn't feel like such a great day anymore. We reached the car, leaned side by side on the front fender. I was weighing up in my mind whether Joe would have been smart enough and careful enough to do what I would have done. I figured maybe he would have been. He'd spent a long time around smart and careful people. Roscoe, I said, if you were the guy walking out of here with Joe's stuff, what would you do? She stopped with the car door half open, thought about it.
I'd keep the briefcase, she said. Take it wherever I was supposed to take it. The rest of the stuff, I'd get rid of it.
That's what I would do as well, I said. Where would you get rid of it?
First place I saw, I guess, she said.
There was a service road running between the hotel and the next one in line. It looped behind the hotels and then out onto the perimeter road. There was a line of dumpsters along a 20-yard stretch of it. I pointed. Suppose he drove out that way, I said. Suppose he stopped and lobbed the garment bag straight into one of those dumpsters.
But he'd have kept the briefcase, right?
Roscoe said. Maybe we aren't looking for the briefcase, I said. Yesterday I drove miles and miles out to that stand of trees, but I hid in the field. A diversion, right? It's a habit. Maybe Joe had the same habit. Maybe he carried a briefcase, but kept his important stuff in the garment bag. Roscoe shrugged, wasn't convinced. We started walking down the service road. Up close, the dumpsters were huge. I had to lever myself up on the edge of each one and peer in. The first one was empty, nothing in it at all, except the baked-on kitchen dirt from years of use. The second one was full. I found a length of studding from some demolished drywall and poked around with it. Couldn't see anything. I heaved myself down and walked to the next one. There was a garment bag in it, lying right on top of some old cartons. I fished for it with the length of wood, hauled it out, tossed it onto the ground at Roscoe's feet, jumped down next to it. It was a battered, well-traveled bag, scuffed and scratched, lots of airline tags all over it. There was a little nameplate in the shape of a miniature gold credit card fastened to the handle. It said, Reacher. Okay, Joe, I said to myself. Let's see if you were a smart guy. I was looking for the shoes. They were in the outside pocket of the bag. Two pairs. Four shoes. Just like it said on the housekeeper's list. I pulled the inner soles out of each one in turn. Under the third one, I found a tiny Ziploc bag with a sheet of computer paper folded up inside it. Smart as a whip, Joe, I said to myself, and laughed. 20. Roscoe and I danced around the service alley together like players in the dugout, watching the winning run soar out of sight. Then we hustled over to the Chevy and raced the mile back to our hotel. Ran into the lobby, into the elevator, unlocked our room and fell in. The telephone was ringing. It was Finley on the line from Margrave again. He sounded as excited as we were. Molly Beth Garden just called, he said. She did it. She's got the files we need. She's flying down here right now. She told me it was amazing stuff. Sounded high as a kite. Atlanta arrivals, 2 o'clock. I'll meet you there. Delta from Washington. Picard give you anything? Sure did, I said. He's quite a guy. I got the rest of the printout, I think. You think? Finley said. You don't know? Only just got back, I said. Haven't looked at it yet. So look at it, for Christ's sake, he said. It's important, right? See you later, Harvard guy, I said. We sat down at the table over by the window, unzipped the little plastic bag and pulled out the paper, unfolded it carefully. It was a sheet of computer paper. The top inch had been torn off the right-hand corner. Half the heading had been left behind. It said, Operation E Unum.
Operation E Unum Pluribus, Roscoe said.
Underneath was a triple-spaced list of initials with telephone numbers opposite. The first set of initials was PH. The phone number was torn off.
Paul Hubble, Roscoe said. His number and the other half of the heading was what Finley found.
I nodded. Then there were four more sets of initials. The first two were WB and KK. They had phone numbers alongside. I recognized a New York area code against KK. The WB area code, I figured I'd have to look up. The third set of initials was JS. The code was 504. New Orleans area. I'd been there less than a month ago. The fourth set of initials was MBG. There was a phone number with a 202 area code. I pointed to it so Roscoe could see it.
Molly Beth Gordon, she said. Washington, D.C.
I nodded again. It wasn't the number I had called from the Rosewood office. Maybe her home number. The final two items on the torn paper were not initials, and there were no corresponding phone numbers. The second-to-last item was just two words, Stoller's Garage. The last item was three words, Gray's Kleiner File.
I looked at the careful capital letters, and I could just about feel my dead brother's neat, pedantic personality bursting off the page. Paul Hubble we knew about. He was dead. Molly Beth Gordon we knew about. She'd be here at 2 o'clock. We'd seen the garage up at Sherman Stoller's place on the golf course. It held nothing but 2 empty cartons. That left the underlined heading, 3 sets of initials with 3 phone numbers and the 3 words, Gray's Kleiner File. I checked the time. Just past noon. Too early to sit back and wait for Molly Beth to arrive. I figured we should make a start. First we think about the heading, I said. E unum pluribus. Roscoe shrugged.
That's the U.S. motto, right? She said. The Latin thing?
No, I said. It's the motto backwards. This more or less means out of one comes many, not out of many comes one.
Could you have written it down wrong?
She said. I shook my head. I doubt it, I said. I don't think Joe would make that kind of a mistake. It must mean something. Roscoe shrugged again.
Doesn't mean anything to me, she said. What else?
Gray's Kleiner File, I said. Did Gray have a file on Kleiner?
Probably, Roscoe said. He had a file on just about everything. Somebody spat on the sidewalk, he put it in a file.
I nodded, stepped back to the bed and picked up the phone, called Finley down in Margrave. Baker told me he had already left, so I dialed the other numbers on Joe's printout. The WB number was in New Jersey, Princeton University, Faculty of Modern History. I hung up straight away, couldn't see the connection. The KK number was in New York City, Columbia University, Faculty of Modern History. I hung up again. Then I dialed JS in New Orleans. I heard one ringtone and a busy voice.
15th Squad, Detective,
the voice said.
Detectives, I said. Is that the NOPD?
15th Squad, the voice said again. Can I help you?
You got somebody there with the initials J.S.? I asked.
J.S., the voice said. I got 3 of them. Which one do you want?
Don't know, I said. Does the name Joe Reacher mean anything to you?
What the hell is this? The voice said. 20 questions or something?
Ask them, will you? I said. Ask each J.S. if they know Joe Reacher. Will you do that? I'll call back later, okay? Down in New Orleans, the 15th Squad desk guy grunted and hung up. I shrugged at Roscoe and put the phone back on the nightstand.
We wait for Molly?
She said. I nodded. I was a little nervous about meeting Molly. It was going to be like meeting a ghost connected to another ghost. We waited at the cramped table in the window. Watched the sun fall away from its noontime peak, wasted time passing Joe's torn printout back and forth between us. I stared at the heading, E unum pluribus, out of one comes many. That was Joe Reacher, in 3 words, something important, all bound up in a wry little pun.
Let's go,
Roscoe said. We were early, but we were anxious. We gathered up our things, rode the elevator to the lobby, and let the dead guys settle up for our phone calls. Then we walked over to Roscoe's Chevy, started threading our way around to arrivals. It wasn't easy. The airport hotels were planned for people heading out of arrivals or heading into departures. Nobody had thought of people going our way.
We don't know what Molly looks like, Roscoe said.
But she knows what I look like, I said. I look like Joe. The airport was vast,
we saw most of it as we crabbed over to the right quarter. It was bigger than some cities I'd been in. We drove for miles, found the right terminal, missed a lane change and passed the short-term parking, came around again and lined up at the barrier. Roscoe snatched the ticket and eased into the lot. "Go left," I said. The lot was packed. I was craning over, looking for spaces. Then I saw a vague black shape slide by in the line on my right. I caught it out of the corner of my eye. "Go right. Go right," I said. I thought it was the rear end of a black pickup, brand new, sliding by on my right. Roscoe hauled the wheel over and we swung into the next aisle. Caught a flash of red brake lights and black sheet metal. A pickup swung out of sight. Roscoe howled down the aisle and cornered hard. The next aisle was empty, nothing moving, just ranks of automobiles standing quiet in the sun. Same thing in the next aisle. Nothing on the move. No black pickup. We drove all over the lot. Took us a long time. We were held up by the cars moving in and out, but we covered the whole area. Couldn't find a black pickup anywhere. But we did find Finley. We parked up in an empty space and started the long walk to the terminal. Finley had parked in a different quarter and was walking in on a different diagonal. He walked the rest of the way with us. The terminal was very busy, and it was huge. Built low, but it spread horizontally over acres. The whole place was crowded. Flickering screens high up announced the arrivals. The 2 o'clock Delta from Washington was in and taxiing. We walked down toward the gate. Felt like a half-mile walk. We were in a long corridor with a ribbed rubber floor. A pair of moving walkways ran down the center of the corridor. On the right was an endless row of bright, gaudy advertisements about the attractions of the Sun Belt. Business or pleasure? It was all down here, that's for sure. On the left was a glass partition, floor to ceiling, with a white etched stripe at eye level to stop people trying to walk through the glass. Behind the glass were the gates. There was an endless sequence of them. The passengers came out of the planes and walked along on their side of the glass. Half of them disappeared sideways into the baggage claim areas. Then they came out again and found exit doors in the glass partition, which let them out into the main corridor. The other half were the short-haul flyers with no checked baggage. They went straight to the doors. Each set of doors was mobbed by big knots of meters and greeters. We pushed our way through them as we headed down. Passengers were spilling out of the doors every 30 yards. Friends and relatives were moving in close, and the two streams of people were colliding. We fought through 8 separate crowds before we got to the right gate. I just pushed my way through. I felt anxious. The glimpse of the black pickup in the lot had unsettled me. We reached the gate. We walked on our side of the glass right past the doors, right down to level with the end of the jetway. People were already coming off the plane. I watched them spilling out of the jetway and turning to walk up toward the baggage area and the exit doors. On our side of the glass, people were walking down to the gates farther on. They were pushing at us as they passed. We were being dragged down the corridor, like swimming in a heavy sea. We were stepping backward all the time just to stay standing still. There was a stream of people behind the glass. I saw a woman coming in who could have been Molly. She was about 35, dressed well in a business suit, carrying a briefcase and a garment bag. I was standing there, trying to get recognized, but she suddenly saw somebody else and pointed and gave a silent shriek behind the glass and blew a kiss to a guy 10 yards from me. He shouldered backward toward the doors to wait for her. Then it seemed like just about any of the women could be Molly. There must have been a couple of dozen candidates. There were blondes and brunettes, tall ones, short ones, pretty ones, homely ones, all dressed for business, all carrying efficient luggage, all striding in with the weary, purposeful manner of tired executives in the middle of a busy day. I watched them all. They flowed with the tide behind the glass, some of them peering out for husbands, lovers, drivers, business contacts, some of them looking straight ahead, all of them carried along in the swarming crowd. One of them had matching burgundy leather luggage, a heavy briefcase in one hand, and a carry-on which she was wheeling on a long handle with the other. She was small, blonde, excited. She slowed as she turned out of the jetway and scanned the crowd through the glass. Her eyes flashed past me, then they snapped back. She looked straight at me, stopped. People piled up behind her. She was pushed forward. She fought her way over to the glass. I moved in close on my side. She stared at me, smiled. "Molly?" I mouthed through the glass at her. She held up the heavy briefcase like a trophy, nodded toward it, smiled a big, wide smile of excited triumph. She was pushed in the back, borne along by the crowd toward the exit. She looked back to see if I was following. Roscoe and Finley and I struggled after her. On Molly's side of the glass, the flow was with her. Our side, it was against us. We were being separated at double speed. There was a solid mob of college kids bearing down on us, aiming to fly out of a gate farther down. Big, well-fed kids, clumsy luggage, rowdy. The three of us were shoved backward 5 yards. Through the glass, Molly was way ahead. I saw her blonde head disappear. I fought sideways and vaulted over onto the moving walkway. It was going the wrong way. I was carried another 5 yards before I made it over the moving hand grip onto the other side. Now I was going in the right direction, but the walkway was a solid mass of people just standing still on it, content with the snail's pace the rubber floor was carrying them. They were standing 3 abreast, no way through at all. I climbed up onto the narrow handrail and tried to walk along it like a tightrope. I had to crouch because I couldn't balance. I fell heavily to my right, got carried 5 yards the wrong way before I could struggle up. I looked around in panic. Through the glass, I could see Molly was being crowded into the baggage claim. I could see Roscoe and Finley were way behind me. I was moving slowly the wrong way. I didn't want Molly to go into the baggage claim. She had flown down here in a hurry. She had urgent news. No way would she have packed a big valise. No way would she have checked any luggage. She shouldn't be going into the baggage claim. I put my head down and ran. Barged people out of the way. I was traveling against the pace of the walkway. The rubber floor was grabbing at my shoes. Each impact was costing me time. People were yelling in outrage. I didn't care. I tore through them and left them sprawling, vaulted off the walkway, and clawed through the crowd at the exit doors. The baggage claim was a wide, low hall lit with dull yellow lights. I fought my way in through the exit lane, looking everywhere for Molly. Couldn't find her. The hall was jammed with people. There must have been 100 passengers standing around the carousel, 3 deep. The belt was grinding around under a heavy load of bags. There were ragged lines of luggage carts on the sidewall. People were lining up to put quarters in a slot and pull them free. They were wheeling them away through the crowd. Carts were clashing and tangling. People were pushing and shoving. I waded into the mass, shouldered my way through, and spun people around, searching for Molly. I'd seen her go in. I hadn't seen her come out. But she wasn't in there. I checked every face. I trawled through the whole hall. I let myself be carried outside on the relentless tide, fought ahead to the exit door. Roscoe was holding tight to the doorframe, battling the flow. "She come out?" I said. "No," she said.
Finlay's gone to the end of the corridor. He's waiting there. I'm waiting here.
We stood there with people pouring past us. Then the crowd coming toward us from the gate was suddenly thinning. The whole plane load was just about through. The last stragglers were strolling down. An old woman in a wheelchair was bringing up the rear. She was being pushed along by an airline employee. The guy had to pause and maneuver his way around something lying in the entrance to the baggage hall. It was a burgundy leather carry-on. It was lying on its side. Its extending handle was still pulled out. From 15 feet away, I could read the fancy gold monogram on the front. It read MBG. Roscoe and I dived back into the baggage claim. In the few minutes I'd been out of there, the place had just about emptied. Not more than a dozen people still in there. Most of them were already hauling their bags off the belt and heading out as we headed in. Within a minute, the hall was deserted. The luggage belt was grinding round, empty. Then it stopped. The hall fell silent. Roscoe and I stood in the sudden quiet and looked at each other. The hall had four walls and a floor and a ceiling. There was an entrance door and an exit door. The carousel snaked in through a hole a yard square and snaked out again through a hole a yard square. Both holes were draped with black rubber curtains cut into slats a few inches wide. Next to the carousel was a cargo door. On our side it was blank, no handle, locked. Roscoe darted back and grabbed Molly Beth's carry-on, opened it up. It held a change of clothes and a toilet bag and a photograph, 8x10 in a brassed frame. He was Joe. He looked like me, but a little thinner, a shaved, tanned scalp, a wry, amused smile. The hall was filled with the shriek of a warning siren. It sounded for a moment, and then the luggage belt graunched back into motion. We stared at it, stared at the shrouded hole it was coming through. The rubber curtains bellied. A briefcase came out. Burgundy leather. The straps were slashed through. The case was open. It was empty. It wobbled mechanically around toward us. We stared at it, stared at the cut straps. They had been severed with a sharp blade, severed by somebody in too much of a hurry to click open the catches. I leapt onto the moving carousel, ran back against the belt's lurching motion, and dove like a swimmer, head first through the rubber slats shrouding the yard-square hole. I landed hard, and the belt started to drag me back out. I scrambled and crawled like a kid on my hands and knees, rolled off and jumped up. I was in a loading bay, deserted. The afternoon blazed outside. There was a stink of kerosene and diesel fuel from the baggage trains hauling in from the planes on the tarmac. All around me were tall piles of forlorn cargo and forgotten suitcases. They were all stacked in three-sided storage bays. The rubber floor was littered with old labels and long barcodes. The place was like a filthy maze. I dodged and skidded about, hopelessly looking for Molly. I ran behind one tall pile after another, into one bay and then the next. I grabbed at the metal racking and heaved myself around the tight corners, glancing around desperately. Nobody there. Nobody anywhere. I ran on, sliding and skidding on the litter. I found her left shoe. It was lying on its side at the entrance to a dark bay. I plunged in. Nothing there. I tried the next bay. Nothing there. I held on to the shelving, breathing hard. I had to organize. I ran to the far end of the corridor, started ducking into each bay in turn, left and right, working my way back as fast as I could in a desperate, breathless zigzag. I found her right shoe, three bays from the end. Then I found her blood. At the entry to the next bay, it was pooled on the floor, sticky, spreading. She was slumped at the back of the bay, on her back in the gloom, jammed between two towers of crates, just sprawled there on the rubber floor.
Blood was pouring out of her. Her gut was torn open. Somebody had jammed a knife in her and ripped it savagely upward under her ribs. But she was alive. One pale hand was fluttering. Her lips were flecked with bright bubbles of blood. Her head was still, but her eyes were roving. I ran to her, cradled her head. She gazed at me, forced her mouth to work.
"Got to get in before Sunday," she whispered.
Then she died in my arms. 21. I studied chemistry in maybe 7 different high schools. Didn't learn much of it, just came away with general impressions. One thing I remember is how you can throw some little extra thing into a glass tube and make everything blow up with a bang. Just some little powder produces a result way bigger than it should. That was how I felt about Molly. I had never met her before, never even heard of her. But I felt angry, way out of all proportion. I felt worse about her than I felt about Joe. What happened to Joe was in the line of his duty. Joe knew that. He would have accepted that. Joe and I knew about risk and duty right from the moment we first knew about anything at all. But Molly was different. The other thing I remember from the chemistry lab is stuff about pressure. Pressure turns cold into diamonds. Pressure does things. It was doing things to me. I was angry, and I was short of time. In my mind, I was seeing Molly coming out of that jetway, striding out, determined to find Joe's brother and help him, smiling a wide smile of triumph, holding up a briefcase of files she shouldn't have copied, risking a lot. For me. For Joe. That image in my mind was building up like massive pressure on some old geological seam. I had to decide how to use that pressure. I had to decide whether it was going to crush me or turn me into a diamond. We were leaning on the front fender of Roscoe's car in the airport short-term lot, stunned and silent. Wednesday afternoon, nearly 3 o'clock. I had hold of Finlay's arm. He had wanted to stay inside and get involved. He had said it was his duty. I had screamed at him that we didn't have time. I had dragged him out of the terminal by force. I had marched him straight to the car because I knew what we did in the next few moments was going to make the difference between winning and losing. "We've got to go get Gray's file," I said. "It's the next best thing." Finlay shrugged, gave up the struggle.
"It's all we got," he said.
Roscoe nodded.
"Let's go," she said.
She and I drove down together in her car. Finlay was in front of us all the way. She and I didn't speak a single word, but Finlay was talking to himself through the whole trip. He was shouting and cursing. I could see his head jerking back and forth in his car, cursing and shouting and yelling at his windshield. Teal was waiting just inside the station house doors, back against the reception counter, stick clutched in his spotty old hand. He saw the three of us coming in and limped away into the big open squad room, sat down at a desk, the desk nearest to the file room door. We walked past him into the Rosewood office, sat down to wait it out. I pulled Joe's torn printout from my pocket and passed it across the desk. Finlay scanned it through.
"Not much, is it?" he said. "What does the heading mean? E unum pluribus? That's backwards, right?"
I nodded. "Out of one comes many," I said. "I don't get the significance." He shrugged, started reading it through again. I watched him study it. Then there was a loud knock on the office door and Baker came in.
Teal's on his way out of the building, he said, talking to Stevenson in the parking lot. You guys need anything? Finley handed him the torn printout. Get me a Xerox of this, will you? He said. Baker stepped out to do it, and Finley drummed his fingers on the desk. Who are all those initials? He said. We only know the dead ones, I said. Hubble and Molly Beth. Two are college numbers, Princeton and Columbia. Last one is a detective down in New Orleans. What about Stoller's garage? He said. You get a look at that? Nothing, I said. Just a couple of empty air conditioner cartons from last year when he was hauling them to Florida and stealing them. Finley grunted, and Baker came back in, handed me Joe's paper with a copy of it. I kept the original and gave the copy to Finley. Teal's gone, Baker said. We hustled out of the office, caught a glimpse of the white Cadillac easing out of the lot, pushed open the file room door. Margrave was a tiny town in the middle of nowhere, but Gray had spent 25 years filling that file room with paper. There was more paper in there than I'd seen in a long time. All four walls had floor-to-ceiling cabinets with doors and crisp white enamel. We pulled open all the doors. Each cabinet was full of rows of files. There must have been 1,000 letter-sized boxes in there. Fiberboard boxes, labels on the spines, little plastic loops under the labels so you could pull the boxes out when you needed them. Left of the door, top shelf, was the A section. Right of the door, low down, the last Z. The K section was on the wall facing the door, left of center, eye level. We found a box labeled Kleiner, right between three boxes labeled Klan and one labeled Clip Springer versus State of Georgia. I put my finger in the little loop, pulled the box out. It was heavy. I handed it to Finley. We ran back to the Rosewood office, laid the box on the Rosewood desk, opened it up. It was full of old, yellowing paper. But it was the wrong paper. It had nothing to do with Kleiner. Nothing at all. It was a 3-inch pile of ancient police department memos. Operational stuff. Stuff that should have been junked decades ago. A slice of history. Procedures to be followed if the Soviet Union aimed a missile at Atlanta. Procedures to be followed if a black man wanted to ride in the front of the bus. A mass of stuff. But none of the headings began with the letter K. Not one word concerned Kleiner. I gazed at the 3-inch pile and felt the pressure build up.
Somebody beat us to it, Roscoe said. They took out the Kleiner stuff and substituted this junk instead.
Finley nodded, but I shook my head.
No, I said. Doesn't make any sense. They'd have pulled the whole box and just thrown it in the trash. Gray did this himself. He needed to hide the stuff, but he couldn't bring himself to spoil his sequence in the file room, so he took the contents out of the box and put in this old stuff instead, kept everything neat and tidy. You said he was a meticulous guy, right?
Roscoe shrugged.
Gray hid it? She said.
He could have done it. He hid his gun in my desk. He didn't mind hiding things. I looked at her. Something she had said was ringing a warning bell.
When did he give you the gun? I asked her.
After Christmas, she said. Not long before he died.
There's something wrong with that, I said. The guy was a detective with 25 years in the job, right? A good detective. A senior, respected guy. Why would a guy like that feel his choice of off-duty weapon should have to be a secret?
That wasn't his problem.
He gave you the box because it held something needed hiding.
He was hiding the gun,
Roscoe said. I told you that.
No, I said. I don't believe that. The gun was a decoy to make sure you kept the box in a locked drawer. He didn't need to hide the gun. Guy like that could have a nuclear warhead for an off-duty weapon if he wanted to. The gun wasn't the big secret. The big secret was something else in the box.
But there isn't anything else in the box, Roscoe said. Certainly no files, right?
We stood still for a second, then we ran for the doors, crashed through and ran over to Roscoe's Chevy in the lot, pulled Gray's file box out of the trunk, opened it up. I handed the Desert Eagle to Finley, examined the box of bullets. Nothing there. There was nothing else in the file box. I shook it out, examined the lid. Nothing there. I tore the box apart, forced the glued seams and flattened the cardboard out. Nothing there. Then I tore the lid apart. Hidden under the corner flap, there was a key, taped to the inside face, where it could never be seen, where it had been carefully hidden by a dead man. We didn't know what the key fit. We discounted anything in the station house, discounted anything in Gray's home, felt those places were too obvious for a cautious man to choose. I stared at the key and felt the pressure building, closed my eyes and built the picture of Gray easing back the corner of that lid and taping his key under it, handing the box to his friend Roscoe, watching her put it in her drawer, watching the drawer roll shut, watching her lock it, relaxing. I built that picture into a movie and ran it in my head twice before it told me what the key fitted. Something in the barber shop, I said. I snatched the Desert Eagle back from Finley and hustled him and Roscoe into the car. Roscoe drove. She fired it up and slewed out of the lot, turned south toward town.
Why?
She said. He used to go in there, I said. 3-4 times a week. The old guy told me that. He was the only white guy ever went in there. It felt like safe territory, away from Teal and Kleiner and everybody else. And he didn't need to go in there, did he? You said he had a big, messy beard and no hair. He wasn't going in there to get barbered. He was going in there because he liked the old guys. He turned to them, gave them the stuff to hide. Roscoe jammed the Chevy to a stop on the street outside the barber shop, and we jumped out and ran in. There were no customers in there, just the two old guys sitting in their own chairs, doing nothing. I held up the key. We've come for Gray's stuff, I said. The younger guy shook his head.
Can't give it to you, my friend, he said.
He walked over and took the key from me, stepped over and pressed it into Roscoe's palm.
Now we can, he said. Old Mr. Gray told us, give it up to nobody except his friend, Miss Roscoe.
He took the key back from her, stepped back to the sink, and stooped down to unlock a narrow mahogany drawer built in underneath, pulled out 3 files. They were thick files, each in an old furred, buff paper cover. He handed one to me, one to Finley, and one to Roscoe. Then he signaled his partner, and they walked through to the back, left us alone. Roscoe sat on the upholstered bench in the window. Finley and I hitched ourselves into the barber chairs, put our feet up on the chrome rests, started reading. My file was a thick stack of police reports. They had all been Xeroxed and faxed, doubly blurred, but I could read them. They formed a dossier put together by Detective James Speranza, 15th Squad, New Orleans Police Department, Homicide Bureau. Speranza had been assigned to homicide 8 years ago. Then he had been assigned 7 more. He had ended up with a case involving 8 homicides. He hadn't cleared any of them, not one. A total failure.